It's the fuel, he said.
What do you mean?
The fuel, he repeated. The tank. He was a bald man in disrupted bedclothes. They used up all their fuel in that one and got rid of the empty container. Look, there's another one over there.
And there?
Kids being kids, they all searched frantically at that point, trying to find an empty fuel container floating to the ground. The first one landed with a hollow thud.
Can we keep it, Papa?
No. He was bombed and shocked, this Papa, and clearly not in the mood. We cannot keep it.
Why not? I'm going to ask my Papa if I can have it, said another of the girls. Me too.
Just past the rubble of Cologne, a group of kids collected empty fuel containers dropped by their enemies. As usual, I collected humans. I was tired, and the year wasn't even halfway over yet. The Visitor. A new ball had been found for Himmel Street soccer. That was the good news. The somewhat unsettling news was that a division of the NSDAP was heading toward them. They'd progressed all the way through Malking, street by street, house by house, and now they stood at Frau Diller's shop, having a quick smoke before they continued with their business. There was already a smattering of air raid shelters in Malking, but it was decided soon after the bombing of Cologne that a few more certainly wouldn't hurt. The NSDAP was inspecting each and every house in order to see if its basement was a good enough candidate. From afar, the children watched. They could see the smoke rising out of the pack. Liesl had only just come out, and she'd walked over to Rudy and Tommy. Harold Mollenhauer was retrieving the ball.
What's going on up there?
Rudy put his hands in his pockets.
The party.
He inspected his friend's progress with the ball in Frau Holzapfel's front hedge.
They're checking all the houses and apartment blocks.
Instant dryness seized the interior of Liesl's mouth.
For what? Don't you know anything? Tell her, Tommy.
Tommy was perplexed.
Well, I don't know. You're hopeless. The pair of you. They need more air raid shelters.
What?
Basements? No, attics. Of course, basements. Jesus, Liesl, you really are thick, aren't you?
The ball was back.
Rudy!
He played onto it, and Liesl was still standing. How could she get back inside without looking too suspicious? The smoke up at Frau Diller's was disappearing, and the small crowd of men was starting to disperse. Panic generated in that awful way, throat and mouth. Air became sand.
Think, she thought. Come on, Liesl. Think. Think.
Rudy scored. Faraway voices congratulated him.
Think, Liesl. She had it.
That's it, she decided. But I have to make it real. As the Nazis progressed down the street, painting the letters LSR on some of the doors, the ball was passed through the air to one of the bigger kids, Klaus Behrig. LSR? Luftschutzraum. Air raid shelter. The boy turned with the ball just as Liesl arrived, and they collided with such force that the game stopped automatically. As the ball rolled off, players ran in. Liesl held her grazed knee with one hand and her head with the other. Klaus Behrig only held his right shin, grimacing and cursing.
Where is she? He spat. I'm going to kill her.
There would be no killing. It was worse. A kindly party member had seen the incident and jogged dutifully down to the group.
What happened here? He asked.
Well, she's a maniac.
Klaus pointed at Liesl, prompting the man to help her up. His tobacco breath formed a smoky sandhill in front of her face.
I don't think you're in any state to keep playing, my girl, he said. Where do you live?
I'm fine, she answered. Really, I can make it myself.
Just get off me. Get off me. That was when Rudy stepped in, the eternal stepperina.
I'll help you home, he said.
Why couldn't he just mind his own business for a change?
Really, Liesel said, just keep playing, Rudy. I can make it. No, no.
He wouldn't be shifted. The stubbornness of him.
It'll only take a minute or two.
Again she had to think, and again she was able. With Rudy holding her up, she made herself drop once more to the ground, on her back.
My papa, she said.
The sky, she noticed, was utterly blue. Not even the suggestion of a cloud.
Could you get him, Rudy?
Stay there.
To his right, he called out.
Tommy, watch her, will you? Don't let her move.
Tommy snapped into action.
I'll watch her, Rudy.
He stood above her, twitching and trying not to smile, as Liesel kept an eye on the party man. A minute later, Hans Hubermann was standing calmly above her.
Hey, Papa.
A disappointed smile mingled with his lips. I was wondering when this would happen. He picked her up and helped her home. The game went on, and the Nazi was already at the door of a lodging a few doors up. No one answered. Rudy was calling out again.
Do you need help, Herr Hubermann?
No, no, you keep playing, Herr Steiner.
Herr Steiner, you had to love Liesel's papa. Once inside, Liesel gave him the information. She attempted to find the middle ground between silence and despair.
Papa!
Don't talk.
The party, she whispered.
Papa stopped. He fought off the urge to open the door and look up the street.
They're checking basements to make shelters.
He set her down. Smart girl, he said, then called for Rosa. They had a minute to come up with a plan, a schmozzle of thoughts.
We'll just put him in Liesel's room, was Mama's suggestion. Under the bed.
That's it? What if they decide to search our rooms as well?
Do you have a better plan?
Correction, they did not have a minute. A 7-punch knock was hammered into the door of 33 Himmel Street, and it was too late to move anyone anywhere. The voice.
Open up!
Their heartbeats fought each other, a mess of rhythm. Liesel tried to eat hers down. The taste of heart was not too cheerful. Rosa whispered.
Jesus Mary!
On this day, it was Papa who rose to the occasion. He rushed to the basement door and threw a warning down the steps. When he returned, he spoke fast and fluent.
Look, there is no time for tricks. We could distract him 100 different ways, but there is only one solution.
He eyed the door and summed up.
Nothing.
That was not the answer Rosa wanted. Her eyes widened.
Nothing? Are you crazy?
The knocking resumed. Papa was strict.
Nothing. We don't even go down there. Not a care in the world.
Everything slowed. Rosa accepted it. Clenched with distress, she shook her head and proceeded to answer the door.
Liesel?
Papa's voice sliced her up. Just stay calm. Verstehst?
Yes, Papa.
She tried to concentrate on her bleeding leg.
Aha! At the door, Rosa was still asking the meaning of this interruption when the kindly party man noticed Liesel. The maniacal soccer player! He grinned. How's the knee?
You don't usually imagine the Nazis being too chirpy, but this man certainly was. He came in and made as if to crouch and view the injury. Does he know? Liesel thought. Can he smell we're hiding a Jew? Papa came from the sink with a wet cloth and soaked it onto Liesel's knee. Does it sting? His silver eyes were caring and calm. The scare in them could easily be mistaken as concern for the injury.
Rosa called across the kitchen. It can't sting enough. Maybe it will teach her a lesson.
The party man stood and laughed.
I don't think this girl is learning any lessons out there, Frau Hubermann.
The cardboard contorted.
Frau Hubermann, I think she teaches lessons.
He handed Liesel a smile.
To all those boys. Am I right, young girl?
Papa shoved the cloth into the grays, and Liesel winced rather than answered. It was Hans who spoke. a quiet, sorry, to the girl. There was the discomfort of silence then, and the party man remembered his purpose.
If you don't mind, he explained, I need to inspect your basement, just for a minute or two, to see if it's suitable for a shelter.
Papa gave Liesel's knee a final dab.
You'll have a nice bruise there too, Liesel.
Casually, he acknowledged the man above them.
Certainly. First door on the right. Please excuse the mess. I wouldn't worry. It can't be worse than some of the others I've seen today. This one?
That's it. The longest 3 minutes in Huberman history. Papa sat at the table. Rosa prayed in the corner, mouthing the words. Liesel was cooked. Her knee, her chest, the muscles in her arms. I doubt any of them had the audacity to consider what they'd do if the basement was appointed as a shelter. They had to survive the inspection first. They listened to Nazi footsteps in the basement. There was the sound of measuring tape. Liesel could not ward off the thought of Max sitting beneath the steps, huddled around his sketchbook, hugging it to his chest. Papa stood. Another idea. He walked to the hall and called out,
Everything good down there?
The answer ascended the steps on top of Max Vandenberg.
Another minute, perhaps. Would you like some coffee? Some tea? No, thank you.
When Papa returned, he ordered Liesel to fetch a book and for Rosa to start cooking. He decided the last thing they should do was sit around looking worried.
Well, come on, he said loudly. Move it, Liesel. I don't care if your knee hurts. You have to finish that book, like you said.
Liesel tried not to break.
Yes, Papa. What are you waiting for?
It took great effort to wink at her, she could tell. In the corridor, she nearly collided with the party man.
In trouble with your papa, huh? Never mind. I'm the same with my own children.
They walked their separate ways. And when Liesel made it to her room, she closed the door and fell to her knees, despite the added pain. She listened first to the judgment that the basement was too shallow, then the goodbyes, one of which was sent down the corridor.
Goodbye, maniacal soccer player!
She remembered herself.
Auf Wiedersehen! Goodbye!
The dream carrier simmered in her hands. According to Papa, Rosa melted next to the stove the moment the party man was gone. They collected Liesel and made their way to the basement, removing the well-placed drop sheets and paint cans. Max Vandenberg sat beneath the steps, holding his rusty scissors like a knife. His armpits were soggy, and the words fell like injuries from his mouth.
I wouldn't have used them, he quietly said.
He held the rusty arms flat against his forehead.
I'm so sorry I put you through that.
Papa lit a cigarette. Rosa took the scissors.
You're alive,
she said.
We all are.
It was too late now for apologies. The Schmunzler. Minutes later, a second knocker was at the door.
Good Lord, another one!
Worry resumed immediately. Max was covered up. Rosa trudged up the basement steps, but when she opened the door this time, it was not the Nazis. It was none other than Rudi Steiner. He stood there, yellow-haired and good-intentioned.
I just came to see how Liesel is.
When she heard his voice, Liesel started making her way up the steps.
I can deal with this one.
Her boyfriend,
Papa mentioned to the paint cans. He blew another mouthful of smoke.
He is not my boyfriend,
Liesel countered, but she was not irritated. It was impossible after such a close call.
I'm only going up because Mama will be yelling out any second. Liesel!
She was on the fifth step.
See?
When she reached the door, Rudi moved from foot to foot.
I just came to see...
He stopped.
What's that smell?
He sniffed.
Have you been smoking in there? Oh, I was sitting with Papa. Do you have any cigarettes? Maybe we can sell some.
Liesl wasn't in the mood for this. She spoke quietly enough so that Mama wouldn't hear.
I don't steal from my papa.
But you steal from certain other places.
Talk a bit louder, why don't you?
Rudy schmunzled.
See what stealing does? You're all worried.
Like you've never stolen anything.
Yes, but you reek of it.
Rudy was really warming up now.
Maybe that's not cigarette smoke after all.
He leaned closer and smiled.
It's a criminal I can smell. You should have a bath.
He shouted back to Tommy Müller.
Hey, Tommy, you should come and have a smell of this.
What did you say?
Trust Tommy.
I can't hear you.
Rudy shook his head in Liesl's direction.
Useless.
She started shutting the door.
Get lost, Saukel. You're the last thing I need right now.
Very pleased with himself, Rudy made his way back to the street. At the mailbox, he seemed to remember what he'd wanted to verify all along. He came back a few steps.
Alles gut, Zamensch? The injury, I mean?
It was June. It was Germany. Things were on the verge of decay. Liesl was unaware of this. For her, the Jew in her basement had not been revealed. Her foster parents were not taken away, and she herself had contributed greatly to both of these accomplishments.
Everything's good,
she said, and she was not talking about a soccer injury of any description. She was fine. Death's Diary. The Parisians. Summer came. For the book thief, everything was going nicely. For me, the sky was the color of Jews. When their bodies had finished scouring for gaps in the door, their souls rose up. When their fingernails had scratched at the wood, and in some cases were nailed into it by the sheer force of desperation, their spirits came toward me, into my arms, and we climbed out of those shower facilities, onto the roof, and up, into eternity's certain breadth. They just kept feeding me, minute after minute, shower after shower. I'll never forget the first day in Auschwitz, the first time in Mauthausen. At that second place, as time wore on, I also picked them up from the bottom of the great cliff, when their escapes fell awfully awry. There were broken bodies and dead sweethearts. Still, it was better than the gas. Some of them I caught when they were only halfway down. Saved you, I'd think, holding their souls in midair as the rest of their being, their physical shells, plummeted to the earth. All of them were light, like the cases of empty walnuts. Smoky sky in those places. The smell like a stove, but still so cold. I shiver when I remember, as I try to derealize it. I blow warm air into my hands to heat them up. But it's hard to keep them warm when the souls still shiver. God. I always say that name when I think of it. God. Twice I speak it. I say his name in a futile attempt to understand. But it's not your job to understand. That's me who answers. God never says anything. You think you're the only one he never answers? Your job is to... And I stop listening to me, because, to put it bluntly, I tire me. When I start thinking like that, I become so exhausted, and I don't have the luxury of indulging fatigue. I'm compelled to continue on, because although it's not true for every person on earth, it's true for the vast majority, that death waits for no man. And if he does, he doesn't usually wait very long. On June the 23rd, 1942, there was a group of French Jews in a German prison on Polish soil. The first person I took was close to the door, his mind racing, then reduced to pacing, then slowing down, slowing down. Please believe me when I tell you that I picked up each soul that day as if it were newly born. I even kissed a few weary, poisoned cheeks. I listened to the last gasping cries. Their vanishing words. I watched their love visions and freed them from their fear. I took them all away and if ever there was a time I needed distraction, this was it. In complete desolation, I looked at the world above. I watched the sky as it turned from silver to grey to the colour of rain. Even the clouds were trying to get away. Sometimes I imagined how everything looked above those clouds, knowing without question that the sun was blonde and the endless atmosphere was a giant blue eye. They were French, they were Jews, and they were you. Part 7. The Complete Duden Dictionary and Thesaurus. Featuring Champagne and Accordions, A Trilogy, Some Sirens, A Sky Stealer, An Offer, The Long Walk to Dachau, Peace, An Idiot and Some Coatmen. Champagne and Accordions. In the summer of 1942, the town of Malking was preparing for the inevitable. There were still people who refused to believe that this small town on Munich's outskirts could be a target, but the majority of the population was well aware that it was not a question of if, but when. Shelters were more clearly marked, windows were in the process of being blackened for the nights, and everyone knew where the closest basement or cellar was. For Hans Hubermann, this uneasy development was actually a slight reprieve. At an unfortunate time, good luck had somehow found its way into his painting business. People with blinds were desperate enough to enlist his services to paint them. His problem was that black paint was normally used more as a mixer to darken other colours, and it was soon depleted and hard to find. What he did have was the knack of being a good tradesman, and a good tradesman has many tricks. He took cold dust and stirred it through, and he worked cheap. There were many houses in all parts of Malking in which he confiscated the window light from enemy eyes. On some of his work days, Liesel went with him. They carted his paint through town, smelling the hunger on some of the streets, and shaking their heads at the wealth on others. Many times on the way home, women with nothing but kids and poverty would come running out and plead with him to paint their blinds. "Frau Haller, I'm sorry, I have no black paint left," he would say. But a little farther down the road, he would always break. There was Tall Man and Long Street. "Tomorrow," he'd promise. "First thing." And when the next morning dawned, there he was, painting those blinds for nothing, or for a cookie or a warm cup of tea. The previous evening, he'd have found another way to turn blue or green or beige to black. Never did he tell them to cover their windows with spare blankets, for he knew they'd need them when winter came. He was even known to paint people's blinds for half a cigarette, sitting on the front step of a house, sharing a smoke with the occupant. Laughter and smoke rose out of the conversation before they moved on to the next job. When the time came to write, I remember clearly what Liesel Memminger had to say about that summer. A lot of the words have faded over the decades. The paper has suffered from the friction of movement in my pocket, but still many of her sentences have been impossible to forget. A small sample of some girl-written words.
That summer was a new beginning, a new end. When I look back, I remember my slippery hands of paint and the sound of Papa's feet on Munich Street, and I know that a small piece of the summer of 1942 belonged to only one man. Who else would do some painting for the price of half a cigarette? That was Papa. That was typical, and I loved him.
Every day when they worked together, he would tell Liesel his stories. There was the Great War, and how his miserable handwriting helped save his life, and the day he met Mama. He said that she was beautiful once, and actually very quiet-spoken.
"Hard to believe, I know, but absolutely true."
Each day there was a story, and Liesel forgave him if he told the same one more than once. On other occasions, when she was daydreaming, Papa would dab her lightly with his brush, right between the eyes. If he misjudged and there was too much on it, a small path of paint would dribble down the side of her nose. She would laugh and try to return the favor, but Hans Hubermann was a hard man to catch out at work. It was there that he was most alive. Whenever they had a break, to eat or drink, he would play the accordion, and it was this that Liesel remembered best. Each morning, while Papa pushed or dragged the paint cart, Liesel carried the instrument.
"Better that we leave the paint behind," Hans told her, "than ever forget the music."
When they paused to eat, he would cut up the bread, smearing it with what little jam remained from the last ration card. Or he'd lay a small slice of meat on top of it. They would eat together, sitting on their cans of paint, and with the last mouthful still in the chewing stages, Papa would be wiping his fingers, unbuckling the accordion case. Traces of breadcrumbs were in the creases of his overalls. Paint-specked hands made their way across the buttons and raked over the keys, or held onto a note for a while. His arms worked the bellows, giving the instrument the air it needed to breathe. Liesel would sit each day with her hands between her knees in the long legs of daylight. She wanted none of those days to end, and it was always with disappointment that she watched the darkness stride forward. As far as the painting itself was concerned, probably the most interesting aspect for Liesel was the mixing. Like most people, she assumed her papa simply took his cart to the paint shop or hardware store and asked for the right color, and away he went. She didn't realize that most of the paint was in lumps, in the shape of a brick. It was then rolled out with an empty champagne bottle. Champagne bottles, Hans explained, were ideal for the job, as their glass was slightly thicker than that of an ordinary bottle of wine. Once that was completed, there was the addition of water, whiting, and glue, not to mention the complexities of matching the right color. The science of Papa's trade brought him an even greater level of respect. It was well and good to share bread and music, but it was nice for Liesel to know that he was also more than capable in his occupation. Competence was attractive. One afternoon, a few days after Papa's explanation of the mixing, they were working at one of the wealthier houses just east of Munich Street. Papa called Liesel inside in the early afternoon. They were just about to move on to another job when she heard the unusual volume in his voice. Once inside, she was taken to the kitchen, where two older women and a man sat on delicate, highly civilized chairs. The women were well-dressed. The man had white hair and sideburns like hedges. Tall glasses stood on the table. They were filled with crackling liquid.
"Well," said the man, "here we go."
He took up his glass and urged the others to do the same. The afternoon had been warm. Liesel was slightly put off by the coolness of her glass. She looked at Papa for approval. He grinned and said,
"Prost, Mädel. Cheers, girl."
Their glasses chimed together, and the moment Liesel raised it to her mouth, she was bitten by the fizzy, sickly, sweet taste of champagne. Her reflexes forced her to spit straight onto her papa's overalls, watching it foam and dribble. A shot of laughter followed from all of them, and Hans encouraged her to give it another try. On the second attempt, she was able to swallow it, and enjoy the taste of a glorious broken rule. It felt great. The bubbles ate her tongue. They prickled her stomach. Even as they walked to the next job, she could feel the warmth of pins and needles inside her. Dragging the cart, Papa told her that those people claimed to have no money.
"So you asked for champagne?"
"Why not?"
He looked across, and never had his eyes been so silver.
"I didn't want you thinking that champagne bottles are used only for rolling paint," he warned her.
"Just don't tell Mama."
"Agreed."
"Can I tell Max?"
"Sure, you can tell Max."
In the basement, when she wrote about her life, Liesel vowed that she would never drink champagne again, for it would never taste as good as it did on that warm afternoon in July. It was the same with accordions.
Many times she wanted to ask her papa if he might teach her to play, but somehow something always stopped her. Perhaps an unknown intuition told her
that she would never be able to play it like Hans Hubermann. Surely not even the world's greatest accordionists could compare. They could never be equal to the casual concentration on Papa's face. Or there wouldn't be a paintwork-traded cigarette slouched on the player's lips. And they could never make a small mistake with a three-note laugh of hindsight. Not the way he could. At times, in that basement, she woke up tasting the sound of the accordion in her ears. She could feel the sweet burn of champagne on her tongue. Sometimes she just sat against the wall, longing for the warm finger of paint to wander just once more down the side of her nose, or to watch the sandpaper texture of her papa's hands. If only she could be so oblivious again, to feel such love without knowing it, mistaking it for laughter, and bread with only the scent of jam spread out on top of it. It was the best time of her life. But it was bombing carpet. Make no mistake. Bold and bright, a trilogy of happiness would continue for summer's duration and into autumn. It would then be brought abruptly to an end, for the brightness had shown suffering the way. Hard times were coming, like a parade.
Duden Dictionary, meaning number one.
Zufriedenheit, happiness, coming from happy, enjoying pleasure and contentment. Related words, joy, gladness, feeling fortunate or prosperous. The Trilogy. While Liesel worked, Rudy ran. He did laps of Hubert Oval, ran around the block, and raced almost everyone from the bottom of Himmel Street to Frau Diller's, giving varied head starts. On a few occasions, when Liesel was helping Mama in the kitchen, Rosa would look out the window and say, "What's that little Saukerl up to this time? All that running out there!" Liesel would move to the window. "At least he hasn't painted himself black again."
"Well, that's something, isn't it?"
Rudy's reasons. In the middle of August, a Hitler Youth carnival was being held, and Rudy was intent on winning four events. The 1500, 400, 200, and of course, the 100. He liked his new Hitler Youth leaders, and wanted to please them, and he wanted to show his old friend Franz Deutscher a thing or two.
"Four gold medals," he said to Liesel one afternoon when she did laps with him at Hubert Oval. "Like Jesse Owens back in 36. "You're not still obsessed with him, are you?"
Rudy's feet rhymed with his breathing.
"Not really. But it would be nice, wouldn't it? It would show all those bastards who said I was crazy. They'd see that I wasn't so stupid after all."
"But can you really win all four events?"
They slowed to a stop at the end of the track, and Rudy placed his hands on his hips.
"I have to."
For 6 weeks he trained, and when the day of the carnival arrived in mid-August, the sky was hot-sunned and cloudless. The grass was overrun with Hitler youths, parents, and a glut of brown-shirted leaders. Rudy Steiner was in peak condition.
"Look," he pointed out. "There's Deutscher."
Through the clusters of crowd, the blonde epitome of Hitler Youth standards was giving instructions to two members of his division. They were nodding and occasionally stretching. One of them shielded his eyes from the sun like a salute.
"You want to say hello?"
Liesel asked.
"No, thanks. I'll do that later."
"When I've won." The words were not spoken, but they were definitely there, somewhere between Rudy's blue eyes and Deutscher's advisory hands. There was the obligatory march around the grounds, the anthem, "Heil Hitler." Only then could they begin. When Rudy's age group was called for the 1500, Liesel wished him luck in a typically German manner.
"Hals und Beinbruch, Saukerl!"
She told him to break his neck and leg. Boys collected themselves on the far side of the circular field. Some stretched, some focused, and the rest were there because they had to be. Next to Liesel, Rudy's mother, Barbara, sat with her youngest children. A thin blanket was brimming with kids and loosened grass.
"Can you see Rudy?"
she asked them.
"He's the one on the far left."
Barbara Steiner was a kind woman whose hair always looked recently combed.
"Where?"
said one of the girls, probably Bettina, the youngest.
"I can't see him at all."
"That last one. No, not there. There."
They were still in the identification process when the starter's gun gave off its smoke and sound. The small Steiners rushed to the fence. For the first lap, a group of seven boys led the field. On the second, it dropped to five, and on the next lap, four. Rudy was the fourth runner on every lap until the last. A man on the right was saying that the boy coming second looked the best. He was the tallest.
"You wait," he told his nonplussed wife. "With 200 left, he'll break away."
The man was wrong. A gargantuan brown-shirted official informed the group that there was one lap to go. He certainly wasn't suffering under the ration system. He called out as the lead pack crossed the line, and it was not the second boy who accelerated, but the fourth. And he was 200 meters early. Rudy ran. He did not look back at any stage. Like an elastic rope, he lengthened his lead until any thought of someone else winning snapped altogether. He took himself around the track as the three runners behind him fought each other for the scraps. In the home stretch, there was nothing but blonde hair and space. And when he crossed the line, he didn't stop, he didn't raise his arm, there wasn't even a bent-over relief. He simply walked another 20 meters, and eventually looked over his shoulder to watch the others cross the line. On the way back to his family, he met first with his leaders, and then with Franz Deutscher. They both nodded.
"Steiner?"
"Deutscher?"
"Looks like all those laps I gave you paid off, huh?"
"Looks like it."
He would not smile until he'd won all four. A point for later reference. Not only was Rudy recognized now as a good school student, he was a gifted athlete, too. For Liesl, there was the 400. She finished seventh, then fourth in her heat of the 200. All she could see up ahead were the hamstrings and bobbing ponytails of the girls in front. In the long jump, she enjoyed the sand packed around her feet more than any distance, and the shot put wasn't her greatest moment either. This day, she realized, was Rudy's. In the 400 final, he led from the backstretch to the end, and he won the 200 only narrowly.
"You getting tired?"
Liesl asked him. It was early afternoon by then.
"Of course not."
He was breathing heavily and stretching his calves.
"What are you talking about, Zaumensch? What the hell would you know?"
When the heats of the 100 were called, he rose slowly to his feet and followed the trail of adolescents toward the track. Liesl went after him.
"Hey, Rudy."
She pulled at his shirt sleeve.
"Good luck." "I'm not tired," he said. "I know."
He winked at her. He was tired. In his heat, Rudy slowed to finish second, and after 10 minutes of other races, the final was called. Two other boys had looked formidable, and Liesl had a feeling in her stomach that Rudy could not win this one. Tommy Müller, who'd finished second to last in his heat, stood with her at the fence.
"He'll win it,"
he informed her.
"I know."
"No, he won't." When the finalists reached the starting line, Rudy dropped to his knees and began digging starting holes with his hands. A balding brown shirt wasted no time in walking over and telling him to cut it out. Liesl watched the adult finger pointing, and she could see the dirt falling to the ground as Rudy brushed his hands together. When they were called forward, Liesl tightened her grip on the fence. One of the boys false-started. The gun was shot twice. It was Rudy. Again, the official had words with him, and the boy nodded. Once more, and he was out. Set for the second time, Liesl watched with concentration, and for the first few seconds, she could not believe what she was seeing. A Another false start was recorded, and it was the same athlete who had done it. In front of her, she created a perfect race in which Rudy trailed but came home to win in the last 10 meters. What she actually saw, however, was Rudy's disqualification. He was escorted to the side of the track and was made to stand there alone as the remainder of boys stepped forward. They lined up and raced. A boy with rusty brown hair and a big stride won by at least 5 meters. Rudy remained. Later, when the day was complete and the sun was taken from Himmel Street, Liesel sat with her friend on the footpath. They talked about everything else, from Franz Deutsch's face after the 1500, to one of the 11-year-old girls having a tantrum after losing the discus. Before they proceeded to their respective homes, Rudy's voice reached over and handed Liesel the truth. For a while, it sat on her shoulder, but a few thoughts later, it made its way to her ear. Rudy's voice. I did it on purpose. When the confession registered, Liesel asked the only question available. But why, Rudy? Why did you do it? He was standing with a hand on his hip, and he did not answer. There was nothing but a knowing smile and a slow walk that lulled him home. They never talked about it again. For Liesel's part, she often wondered what Rudy's answer might have been had she pushed him. Perhaps 3 medals had shown what he'd wanted to show, or he was afraid to lose that final race. In the end, the only explanation she allowed herself to hear was an inner teenage voice. Because he isn't Jesse Owens. Only when she got up to leave did she notice the 3 imitation gold medals sitting next to her. She knocked on the Steiner's door and held them out to him.
You forgot these.
No, I didn't. He closed the door, and Liesel took the medals home. She walked with them down to the basement and told Max about her friend, Rudi Steiner.
He truly is stupid, she concluded.
Clearly, Max agreed, but I doubt he was fooled. They both started work then, Max on his sketchbook, Liesel on the dream carrier. She was in the latter stages of the novel, where the young priest was doubting his faith after meeting a strange and elegant woman. When she placed it face down on her lap, Max asked when she thought she'd finish it.
A few days, at the most.
Then a new one? The book thief looked at the basement ceiling.
Maybe, Max.
She closed the book and leaned back.
If I'm lucky.
The next book. It's not the Duden Dictionary and Thesaurus, as you might be expecting. No, the dictionary comes at the end of this small trilogy, and this is only the second installment. This is the part where Liesel finishes The Dream Carrier and steals a story called A Song in the Dark. As always, it was taken from the mayor's house. The only difference was that she made her way to the upper part of town alone. There was no Rudy that day. It was a morning rich with both sun and frothy clouds. Liesel stood in the mayor's library with greed in her fingers and book titles at her lips. She was comfortable enough on this occasion to run her fingers along the shelves, a short replay of her original visit to the room, and she whispered many of the titles as she made her way along. Under the Cherry Tree, The 10th Lieutenant. Typically, many of the titles tempted her, but after a good minute or two in the room, she settled for A Song in the Dark, most likely because the book was green, and she did not yet own a book of that color. The engraved writing on the cover was white, and there was a small insignia of a flute between the title and the name of the author. She climbed with it from the window, saying thanks on her way out. Without Rudy, she felt a good degree of absence, but on that particular morning, for some reason, the book thief was happiest alone. She went about her work and read the book next to the Amper River, far away from the occasional headquarters of Victor Chemmel and the previous gang of Arthur Berg. No one came, no one interrupted, and Liesel read 4 of the very short chapters of A Song in the Dark,
and she was happy. It was the pleasure and satisfaction of good stealing.
A week later, the trilogy of happiness was completed. In the last days of August, a gift arrived, or in fact was noticed. It was late afternoon. Liesel was watching Christina Müller jumping rope on Himmel Street. Rudi Steiner skidded to a stop in front of her on his brother's bike.
"Do you have some time?"
he asked. She shrugged.
"For what?" "I think you'd better come."
He dumped the bike and went to collect the other one from home. In front of her, Liesel watched the pedals spin. They rode up to Grunderstrasse, where Rudi stopped and waited.
"Well?" Liesel asked. "What is it?"
Rudi pointed.
"Look closer."
Gradually they rode to a better position, behind a blue spruce tree. Through the prickly branches, Liesel noticed the closed window and then the object leaning on the glass.
"Is that?"
Rudi nodded. They debated the issue for many minutes before they agreed it needed to be done. It had obviously been placed there intentionally, and if it was a trap, it was worth it. Among the powdery blue branches, Liesel said,
"A book thief would do it."
She dropped the bike, observed the street, and crossed the yard. The shadows of clouds were buried among the dusky grass. Were they holes for falling into, or patches of extra darkness for hiding in? Her imagination sent her sliding down one of those holes into the evil clutches of the mayor himself. If nothing else, those thoughts distracted her, and she was at the window even quicker than she'd hoped. It was like the Whistler all over again. Her nerves licked her palms. Small streams of sweat rippled under her arms. When she raised her head, she could read the title. The Complete Duden Dictionary and Thesaurus. Briefly, she turned to Rudi and mouthed the words,
"It's a dictionary."
He shrugged and held out his arms. She worked methodically, sliding the window upward, wondering how all of this would look from inside the house. She envisioned the sight of her thieving hand reaching up, making the window rise until the book was felled. It seemed to surrender slowly, like a falling tree.
Got it.
There was barely a disturbance or sound. The book simply tilted toward her, and she took it with her free hand. She even closed the window, nice and smooth, then turned and walked back across the potholes of clouds.
"Nice,"
Rudi said as he gave her the bike.
"Thank you."
They rode toward the corner where the day's importance reached them. Liesel knew. It was that feeling again, of being watched. A voice pedaled inside her, two laps.
"Look at the window. Look at the window."
She was compelled. Like an itch that demands a fingernail, she felt an intense desire to stop. She placed her feet on the ground and turned to face the mayor's house and the library window, and she saw. Certainly she should have known this might happen, but she could not hide the shock that loitered inside when she witnessed the mayor's wife standing behind the glass. She was transparent, but she was there. Her fluffy hair was as it always was, and her wounded eyes and mouth and expression held themselves up for viewing. Very slowly, she lifted her hand to the book thief on the street. A motionless wave. In her state of shock, Liesel said nothing to Rudi or herself. She only steadied herself and raised her hand to acknowledge the mayor's wife in the window. Duden Dictionary. Meaning number 2. Verzeihung. Forgiveness. To stop feeling anger, animosity, or resentment. Related words, absolution, acquittal, mercy. On the way home, they stopped at the bridge and inspected the heavy black book. As Rudi flipped through the pages, he arrived at a letter. He picked it up and looked slowly toward the book thief.
"It's got your name on it."
The river ran.
Liesel took hold of the paper. The letter.
Dear Liesel, I know you find me pathetic and loathsome. Look that word up if you don't know it. But I must tell you that I am not so stupid as to not see your footprints in the library. When I noticed the first book missing, I thought I had simply misplaced it. But then I saw the outlines of some feet on the floor in certain patches of the light. It made me smile. I was glad that you took what was rightfully yours. I then made the mistake of thinking that would be the end of it. When you came back, I should have been angry, but I wasn't. I could hear you the last time, but I decided to leave you alone. You only ever take one book, and it will take 1,000 visits till all of them are gone. My only hope is that one day you will knock on the front door and enter the library in the more civilized manner. Again, I am sorry we could no longer keep your foster mother employed. Lastly, I hope you find this dictionary and thesaurus useful as you read your stolen books. Yours sincerely, Ilse Hermann.
We'd better head home, Rudy suggested.
But Liesel did not go.
Can you wait here for 10 minutes?
Of course. Liesel struggled back up to 8 Grunderstrasse and sat on the familiar territory of the front entrance. The book was with Rudy, but she held the letter and rubbed her fingers on the folded paper as the steps grew heavier around her. She tried 4 times to knock on the daunting flesh of the door, but she could not bring herself to do it. The most she could accomplish was to place her knuckles gently on the warmness of the wood. Again, her brother found her. From the bottom of the steps, his knee healing nicely, he said,
"Come on, Liesel. Knock."
As she made her second getaway, she could soon see the distant figure of Rudy at the bridge. The wind showered through her hair, her feet swam with the pedals. Liesel Memminger was a criminal, but not because she'd stolen a handful of books through an open window. "You should have knocked," she thought, and although there was a good portion of guilt, there was also the juvenile trace of laughter. As she rode, she tried to tell herself something. "You don't deserve to be this happy, Liesel. You really don't. Can a person steal happiness, or is it just another internal, infernal human trick?" Liesel shrugged away from her thoughts. She crossed the bridge and told Rudy to hurry up and not to forget the book. They rode home on rusty bikes. They rode home a couple of miles, from summer to autumn, and from a quiet night to the noisy breath of the bombing of Munich. The Sound of Sirens. With the small collection of money Hans had earned in the summer, he brought home a second-hand radio. "This way," he said, "we can hear when the raids are coming, even before the sirens start. They make a cuckoo sound, and then announce the regions at risk." He placed it on the kitchen table and switched it on. They also tried to make it work in the basement, for Max, but there was nothing but static and severed voices in the speakers. In September, they did not hear it as they slept. Either the radio was already half broken, or it was swallowed immediately by the crying sound of sirens. A hand was shoved gently at Liesel's shoulder as she slept. Papa's voice followed it in, afraid. "Liesel, wake up. We have to go." There was the disorientation of interrupted sleep, and Liesel could barely decipher the outline of Papa's face. The only thing truly visible was his voice. In the hallway, they stopped. "Wait," said Rosa. Through the dark, they rushed to the basement. The lamp was lit. Max edged out from behind the paint cans and drop sheets. His face was tired, and he hitched his thumbs nervously into his pants. "Time to go, huh?" Hans walked to him. "Yes, time to go." He shook his hand and slapped his arm. "We'll see you when we get back, right?" "Of course." Rosa hugged him, as did Liesel. "Goodbye, Max." Weeks earlier, they'd discussed whether they should all stay together in their own basement, or if the three of them should go down the road, to a family by the name of Fiedler. It was Max who convinced them. They said it's not deep enough here. I've already put you in enough danger. Hans had nodded. It's a shame we can't take you with us. It's a disgrace. It's how it is. Outside, the sirens howled at the houses, and the people came running, hobbling, and recoiling as they exited their homes. Night watched. Some people watched it back, trying to find the tin can planes as they drove across the sky. Himmel Street was a procession of tangled people, all wrestling with their most precious possessions. In some cases, it was a baby. In others, a stack of photo albums or a wooden box. Liesel carried her books between her arm and her ribs. Frau Holzapfel was heaving a suitcase, laboring on the footpath with bulbous eyes and small-stepped feet. Papa, who'd forgotten everything, even his accordion, rushed back to her and rescued the suitcase from her grip. "Jesus, Mary and Joseph, what have you got in here?" he asked. "An anvil?" Frau Holzapfel advanced alongside him. "The necessities?" The Fiedlers lived six houses down. They were a family of four, all with wheat-coloured hair and good German eyes. More important, they had a nice, deep basement. 22 people crammed themselves into it, including the Steiner family, Frau Holzapfel, Pfiffikus, a young man, and a family named Jensen. In the interest of a civil environment, Rosa Hubermann and Frau Holzapfel were kept separated, though some things were above petty arguments. One light globe dangled from the ceiling, and the room was dank and cold. Jagged walls jutted out and poked people in the back as they stood and spoke. The muffled sound of sirens leaked in from somewhere. They could hear a distorted version of them that somehow found a way inside. Although creating considerable apprehension about the quality of the shelter, they at least could hear the three sirens that would signal the end of the raid and safety. They didn't need a Luftschutzwart, an air raid supervisor. It wasn't long before Rudi found Liesel and was standing next to her. His hair was pointing at something on the ceiling.
"Isn't this great?"
She couldn't resist some sarcasm.
"It's lovely." "Ah, come on, Liesel, don't be like that. What's the worst that can happen, apart from all of us being flattened or fried or whatever bombs do?"
Liesel looked around, gauging the faces. She started compiling a list of who was most afraid. The hit list. 1. Frau Holzapfel. 2. Mr. Fiedler. 3. The young man. 4. Rosa Hubermann. Frau Holzapfel's eyes were trapped open. Her wiry frame was stooped forward, and her mouth was a circle. Herr Fiedler busied himself by asking people, sometimes repeatedly, how they were feeling. The young man, Rolf Schulz, kept to himself in the corner, speaking silently at the air around him, castigating it. His hands were cemented into his pockets. Rosa rocked back and forth, ever so gently.
"Liesel," she whispered,
"come here."
She held the girl from behind, tightening her grip. She sang a song, but it was so quiet that Liesel could not make it out. The notes were borne on her breath, and they died at her lips. Next to them, Papa remained quiet and motionless. At one point, he placed his warm hand on Liesel's cool skull. "You'll live," it said, and it was right. To their left, Alex and Barbara Steiner stood with the younger of their children, Emma and Bettina. The two girls were attached to their mother's right leg. The oldest boy, Kurt, stared ahead in a perfect Hitler Youth stance, holding the hand of Karin, who was tiny, even for her 7 years. The 10-year-old Anna Marie played with the pulpy surface of the cement wall. On the other side of the Steiners were Pfiffikus and the Jensen family. Pfiffikus kept himself from whistling. The bearded Mr. Jensen held his wife tightly, and their two kids drifted in and out of silence. Occasionally they pestered each other, but they held back when it came to the beginning of true argument. After 10 minutes or so, What was most prominent in the cellar was a kind of non-movement. The bodies were welded together, and only their feet changed position or pressure. Stillness was shackled to their faces.